Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Cohen. When you visualize Montana, what comes to mind? Small cities and towns, stunning mountains, beautiful rivers, perhaps. It might be any number of things, but chances are it is not abused and neglected children. Or that as of September 23rd of this year, 2,693 Montana kids are in foster care homes, or that 433 of those were eligible for adoption. If those numbers seem staggering, they are. Since 2008, documented cases of abuse and neglect are up more than 60%, and the number of children in foster care has increased by one-third in the past 2.5 years. Sarah Corbelly knows something about this. She's in charge of the Child and Family Services Division of the Montana Department of Health and Human Services. Sarah, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thank you for having me.
Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
I grew up in the Twin Cities in Minnesota, and my parents were both small business owners. My father was a manufacturer's representative, and my mother was an interior designer.
What'd you pick up from that, let's say, going into high school? How would you describe yourself, your core values?
I think that I would say I was raised to believe in the value of always working hard, giving your job the best that you have, and never giving up.
Interesting. What led you into this line of work?
When I was in high school, I spent a lot of time volunteering at the Children's Hospital in Minneapolis with terminally ill children, and then my senior year I switched to abused and neglected children volunteering at a shelter, and the profound difference in the children really struck me. Terminally ill children had always been somewhat inspiring and full of wisdom and insight, and I had thought I wanted to work in a hospital, and then when I met these children in this child abuse and neglect shelter, I was struck by the profound impact that abuse and neglect had had on them, and I wanted to do more for that population of children. I felt like there were some significant needs that perhaps as a society we weren't doing a good job of meeting.
Where did that lead you?
Well, it led me to social work school at the University of Montana in Missoula. And so I got my social work degree and went to work for Missoula Youth Homes and spent several years working with children who were wards of the state in the child protection system. And then it led me to law school at the University of Denver, where they have a children's advocacy clinic and where I was able to be a pediatric legal clerk for an attorney at the Kemp Children's Center for the Prevention and Treatment of Child Abuse and Neglect.
What did you learn in that role, the legal side, that you didn't know going in?
I learned a lot about the balancing of children's rights and parents' rights and the tension that exists in our country between those rights and sort of the history of child abuse and neglect. Dr. Henry Kemp wrote The Battered Child Syndrome in 1962, and so it was basically the beginning of a conversation in our country about the need to protect children from their parents, and that's a hard conversation to have.
I imagine it's among the hardest conversations to have. We're going to talk about that because, correct me if I'm wrong, foster care involves the removal of the child from the natural home, often involuntarily, that is on the part of the parents, correct?
You are correct.
And adoption is the same?
Yes, for a child to be adopted from the state foster care system, a court has to terminate their parental rights, the parental rights of their birth parents, before that can happen.
Now, in your experience, do parents often resist that move by the state to terminate their rights?
In my experience, it really often depends on the parent and where that child is placed. In the best of all cases, the parents are able to maintain a relationship with the child and the adoptive or other placement, and that child has more people that love him or her. I heard once a very sort of poignant saying that I think is accurate, that I don't think children often believe in a subtractive model of love. So the more people who can love a child, the better.
Someone might say, if the parents love the child, why remove them from the home?
And I think that's a question that we should all ask and draw the line at safety. I think it's really about ensuring the safety of children and making sure that when that decision is made, it's made because that child really is unsafe and in some sort of immediate danger in his or her home.
Okay, now if I'm hearing you right, there are situations where the parents love the child, but in fact are putting the child in danger.
Yes.
So why the shift from attorney to administrative structures that are supposed to protect children?
I think the shift came as a result of my background. I have an undergrad degree in social work and then my law degree, but really I spent most of my law school working with a large multidisciplinary team at the Kemp Center, so doctors, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, lawyers, and I guess I felt that coming to my current role gave me the opportunity to work with the larger system rather than just within the legal system. The child protection system involves so many different stakeholders and families and community members, and so I left the legal process to look at the larger picture and maybe have an opportunity to do some things where we might get involved earlier and actually prevent child abuse and neglect rather than just responding to it after the fact within the legal system.
And how long have you been in the administrative side?
I have been with the division 5.5 years, and in my current role, about 4.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Sarah Corbally, the director of the Child and Family Services Division of the Montana Department of Health and Human Services. You've described what I think anyone would say is a complex system involving a diversity of professional levels of expertise. Let's start with nuts and bolts. Montana has a child abuse hotline, and I read in a Billings Gazette article of earlier this year that last year, 2014, it rang nearly 100 times a day. Is that accurate?
That is accurate.
All right, the phone rings. What happens in your agency?
When someone calls the child abuse hotline, we have staff that are available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. There are actually about 20 of them who staff the hotline, and they're called centralized intake specialists, and they would answer the call and talk to the reporter and gather as much information as they could in order to determine whether that report rises to the level requiring an actual investigation.
That's a critically serious judgment call to make. How do you decide who holds that position or those positions?
So the qualifications do require a 4-year degree in social work or in human services and related experience. However, the structure is such that all of those decisions are also reviewed by a supervisor because obviously they're pretty important decisions.
Let's say the call is made, yes, it requires or justifies an investigation. What happens?
Well, once that decision is made, then it is given a priority response time. So some calls you need to go right now, and some calls are such that the child is in a safe place at the moment. Let's say maybe the parents aren't living together and there are only allegations against the one parent where the child's not, so you could wait longer. So every call is given a priority, and then it's called out to the field. So we have 29 different field offices, and if there's an investigation, it gets assigned to a child protection specialist in one of those offices.
And a child protection specialist has what qualifications?
A child protection specialist also has to have a 4-year degree in social work or related human services and requires 2 years of direct experience in the field before they're qualified to apply.
Do they have to get some kind of judicial approval, a search warrant or anything like that?
No, not in Montana. Some states require that, but in Montana, they just require that within 5 working days, the affidavit written by the child protection specialist and the petition written by a county attorney or assistant attorney general be filed with the court. And then the court has to have a hearing on that initial petition within 20 days.
How often does an involved or accused parent say, it's not a problem, my child was exaggerating, or my husband hates me and is lying?
Well, anecdotally, I think it's probably less frequent for a parent to say that. I really think that if a child protection specialist approaches this from a public health model or a civil law model, where it's not are you guilty or are you innocent, but it's really important for all of us that your child is safe, that more often than not, a parent can recognize when they need help.
So you're saying the approach of the specialist, the psychological approach, matters tremendously, I'm hearing.
I am saying that, yes.
That's highly interesting, makes perfect sense to me. How long has that been in standard practice, not just in Montana, but let's say across the country?
I don't know that I could pick an actual date at which, you know, that became the national standard or national model. I think that it's been an evolution, perhaps. I can tell you that Dr. Henry Kemp in the late 60s, when he was working on research in the field of child abuse and neglect prevention and treatment, advocated a public health model for that reason, because taking an adversarial approach to many of these cases doesn't result in the best outcomes for children and families.
So let's say the parent says, yeah, we've got a problem here. Where's the line in working with the family to try to solve the problem and removing the child to foster care?
The line is really about whether a child can be made safe in his or her home while we work on the issues that are causing us to be involved. So sometimes you can have a safe relative or safe person move in to that home while that family is working with us instead of placing the child into foster care. Sometimes the issues are such that you can provide intensive in-home services and
manage.
What
does that mean?
That means that you would have a service provider, not our division, but on contract, usually a nonprofit, who would be coming into the home to work with that family on whatever parenting issues were creating the risk or the safety hazards for that child in the home. For example, a lot of times we will deal with neglect. So a young mother who has had, you know, several children close to one another and is under a lot of stress and perhaps struggling to find employment or go back to school and is not able to meet the needs of the children given all of the challenges that she might be facing at that point in time. So maybe the in-home service provider can help her with behavior management techniques for multiple toddlers and can also help her fill out school applications and could help her perhaps with transportation or childcare, any of those support services that might be leading to this rising stress level in the home that really oftentimes leads to abuse or neglect when things don't go very well and there isn't help available to support that parent.
You've used the words abuse and neglect. So neglect is the kids not getting enough of love, attention, food, clean clothes. Add something if I'm missing something.
Yes, you're getting most of it. Okay. It could be medical care, education, all of those
things. All right, what's abuse?
Abuse is usually defined as physical abuse, so the things you hear of shaken babies or abusive head trauma or sexual abuse. And those are often criminal offenses, so those cases can look very different than a young mother who is struggling to parent.
Let's say the decision is made it will not work in the family, the child should go to foster care. What's the process?
The process is basically there are two different parallel tracks. If the child is not going to be able to stay in the family, we have the option of working voluntarily with the family for up to 30 days. So if you think you can make a child safe and go home, then you could sign a voluntary agreement. But Otherwise, it really involves going to court and filing the legal paperwork to begin the process to have the judge and attorneys and guardian ad litems become involved to also advocate for the different parties. And the other track, I would say, really then becomes finding the best placement for that child. And within the statute, there are sort of a hierarchy of placements that you're supposed to look for. And obviously, the most important person that that child could go with would be a non-custodial parent. If there's another parent who doesn't have any allegations of abuse or neglect against him or her, then they would have the highest priority to have their child, which would make sense. If that were my child, I would want them to come to me versus anyone else. If not the other parent, then you look to extended family or what we call kinship providers. And kinship is just anyone that child has a significant relationship with prior to coming into foster care. So if there's no family, no kin, then you would look for a foster home with a licensed foster parent that that child would have no prior relationship with, but that family has training and is prepared to take children in foster care.
We're going to do a separate show on what kind of training foster families are required to have. But I'm understanding you to say this is a judicial decision.
Only if it's contested.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But to even allow the kid to be in foster care, yes, you are correct about that. Which kind of foster care is sort of left to the agency unless there's a big dispute about it.
An investigation to determine whether to make a recommendation to remove a child from his or her home is obviously a serious, serious deal. How many people do you have working in that area?
We have 178 child protection specialists across the state, but unfortunately, about 30 of those positions are generally vacant, and we have a hard time recruiting and filling and keeping child protection specialists for a variety of reasons.
In summary, because it's a lot of complex subject and a short show, what are some of the reasons it's hard to hire and retain?
I think one of the top reasons is workload. There's not enough time to do all of the required paperwork, and there's not enough time to see all of your kids and get out and do everything that you would like to do. And so I think that leads to a lot of stress, and I think people decide that it's not a job they can continue to do.
You say caseload. What's the average caseload that these people are carrying?
Well, we have to hand count our caseloads because we work off a very ancient CAPS system, Child Adult Protective Services system, that won't count them for us. But from our counting, I can tell you that the average child protection specialist has about 18 open investigations and has nearly 15 to 20 children on their caseload as well.
That seems to me to be very high given the severity and complexity of these matters. What's your sense?
I would agree. In terms of the Child Welfare League of America's recommendations, they would recommend 4 investigations, while we have approximately 18, and they would say about 10 cases, and we have workers easily carrying double of that, so way over the recommended levels.
I'm confused by 18 cases, 4 cases, 10 cases.
18 means the number of investigations, so that's deciding if you're going to court or not. 10 is you've gone to court and now you're managing that case while the court case goes.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Sarah Corbelly, head of the Child and Family Services Division of the Montana Department of Health and Human Services. In October, the legislative auditor made a finding that was, I happened to see in the newspaper, said that your division needs to strengthen its supervision and make it a priority to better document reports and investigations and complete more investigations within the time frame required by law. If that's an accurate summary of what they said, what do you say?
I think that is an accurate summary. We've been saying that we have those issues for quite some time. But I would say that when you're asking your workers to carry caseloads that exceed national standards by over 4 times in the area they were focusing on, that you should expect to see that not every performance standard can be met. I don't think it's humanly possible.
And they were looking at these investigations specifically?
Correct.
I'm not going to ask your opinion on whether or not there's any partisanship in that legislative audit's findings. I will ask you, what's the background on this staffing issue? I recall something in the 2013 session where the governor's budget asked for more people for your office. Can you fill us in on that?
That's correct. In 2013, we had requested an additional 13.5 FTE, full-time employees, and the legislature did not fund them. So the governor provided us with some emergency stopgap funding, and we did request funding in 2015, and the bill ultimately died. However, in final negotiations, it did get included in the House Bill 2, the major budget bill, that we did receive some additional resources for some modified temporary staff positions.
What does modified temporary staff positions mean?
It means that we have funding for staff, but we don't have actual FTE for staff. So we continue to have to work through the government processes to try to keep our number of staff high enough to address the large increases we've seen in children in foster care.
Let's talk about that for a moment, large increases. I gave some figures at the top of the show that are quite staggering. I think it was 2,693 kids in foster care. What's the situation now? We're several months down the road. That was September. We're recording this in November. Situation holding steady or not?
We've seen that number rise again to 2,788 children, and we continue to see more children coming into care at a faster rate than we've seen in past times.
What's going on?
One of the largest driving factors is parental drug use, including methamphetamines and prescription drugs. We've tracked the number of children in foster care that are in foster care as a result of parental methamphetamine use. And since 2010, it's risen from about 230 to 850.
Back to the legislative audit. Normally they have some sort of follow-up. Was there a hearing to discuss the findings? And if so, what happened?
There was a hearing, and I think it was a good discussion about why the department is, you know, experiencing the issues that it's experiencing, and the fact that the audit was a very narrow focus. Only you can't take the work we do and look at just a part of the picture and understand the needs of the children and families in this state and ensure that we're meeting those needs. So I think we had a good discussion at the audit committee.
Did anybody on the audit committee say you needed more staff and say they were willing to support the appropriations to do it?
No.
So given the caseload, the investigative caseload, I think, which is 4.5 times what national authorities recommend, who is accepting the responsibility to evaluate what the hell to do about it?
Well, I think Governor Bullock has stepped up and met that challenge by creating the Protect Montana Kids Commission, which consists of 12 different stakeholders from around the state, and they are charged by executive order at looking at exactly that and making recommendations for the next legislative session.
I assume you have someone looking over your shoulder as a department or division of a department in terms of the quality of the work you do. Is the federal government involved in that?
Yes. The Federal Administration for Children and Families is the oversight agency for us, and they do child and family service reviews for all states. We are going into round 3 of child and family service reviews. Montana's previous reviews were in 2004 and 2008, and not one state ever has passed. I do think that it's become more of a compliance paperwork focus than really a focus on achieving what's best for children and families, and I think that's unfortunate. I think that the Federal Administration for Children and Families is in the process of maybe trying to make it more relevant. But at this point, to be honest, it remains a 100-page federal review tool that looms out there over workers' heads and is just additional paperwork.
And how many new kids are coming into foster care in Montana each year?
We are having children enter care at a rate of over 1,500 a year, and that's higher. Historically, it was closer to 1,000, but the last 2 years, it's been over 1,500.
I regret we're getting close to running out of time. In summary, what's the transition between foster care and adoption? Is that a separate court proceeding?
Well, adoptions are done in a separate chapter of Montana law, Title 42, not Title 41, but they're connected in that the child has to be free for adoption in our abuse or neglect case before the child can be adopted. So that means a judge has to make a decision to terminate parental rights.
And how often, how many, I said there were 433 kids at the time of that report that were eligible for adoption?
That's correct.
Eligible for adoption and having homes that will adopt are two different things. Is it a problem?
Yes, I think there's always a struggle to find enough homes for children, and particularly older children who are looking to be adopted. So last year we completed 259 adoptions, but that's not as high as the number of eligible children, so that gives you an idea that there are children out there just waiting for an adoptive family.
And is it similar with a foster care?
Yes, I think it's similar in that it is difficult to find enough foster homes. As I said earlier, we do look for kinship homes where children have family or prior relationships, and I think that's what's saved us as we've seen the large increase. People who have these relationships with these children have stepped up and become placements for them, and we're grateful for their willingness to do that for these kids.
Earlier you said you shifted from legal practice to administrative work because you thought you might be able to have a better, broader impact on more aspects of the problem and get into prevention. Sounds like you're riding a wave that's a tidal wave. Am I wrong? Are you hopeful? Are you pessimistic? What do you say?
Well, I think it depends on the day or the moment, but I still am hopeful, and I believe that it's a job that's bigger than just my division. So there are things going on in the larger department that make me hopeful. But within my division, unfortunately, there has been a tidal wave, and so we haven't gotten to do the prevention focus that I had hoped when I took this job.
Help me. I could use some hopefulness. What are the preventative things that are going on in the department?
Well, we have some evidence-based early intervention home visiting programs that are being implemented in many communities across the state. Some things like nurse-family partnership or safe care augmented that really have the research behind them that show that families who receive those services are much less likely to come into the child protection system in the future. So the fact that we're growing programs that actually prevent children from coming into this system makes me hopeful.
Sarah Corbally, I very much regret to say we're out of time. As I said, we will pursue this subject. To our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.